We act as though comfort and luxury were the chief requirements of life, when all that we need to make us really happy is something to be enthusiastic about.
Bad. Money Machine. 84. End of October.
The Mad Money Machine, nominated as Best Business Podcast.
Mad Money Machine, named by Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine as one of the must-read blogs.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back to the Mad Money Machine. My name is Paul Douglas Boyer. Thank you for joining me on this show. Coming up on this show, we will spin the wheel at Guru Roulette. I'll show you a tool in the crib, which is fundamental to investing, I think. And we'll talk about soccer, we'll talk about happiness, and talk about lots of other stuff. Article about happiness in the October 15th edition of Newsweek magazine. Why money doesn't buy happiness? Economists and psychologists and the rest of us have long wondered if more money would make us happier. Here's the answer. I'll have a link to this article. In the middle of it, it says that talking about all the choices we have and how happy we should be because of choices, they say the trouble is choice is not all it's cracked up to be. Studies show that people like selecting from among maybe a half a dozen kinds of pasta at the grocery store, but find 27 choices overwhelming, leaving them chronically on edge that they could have chosen a better one than the one they did. At the end of the article, they say, if money doesn't buy happiness, what does? Grandma was right when she told you to value your health and friends, not money and stuff. Once your basic needs are met, differences in well-being are less frequently due to income and more frequently due to factors such as social relationships and enjoyment at work. If more money doesn't buy happiness, then the behavior of most Americans looks downright insane as we work harder and longer, decade after decade, to fatten our W-2s. But what's insane for an individual is crucial for a national economy, that is, ever more growth and consumption. Gilbert says, economies can blossom and grow only if people are deluded into believing that the production of wealth will make them happy. Economies thrive when individuals strive, but because individuals will strive only for their own happiness, it's essential that they mistakenly believe that producing and consuming are routes to personal well-being. In other words, if you want to do your part for your country's economy, forget all of the above about money not buying happiness. Jonathan Clements had an article in Sunday's edition of the Wall Street Journal, which there is no Sunday edition, so it's the online version, I guess. He talks about, you're not super rich. You lucked out. Great wealth is overrated. October 21st article. He says, it seems obvious that your life would be better if you had a gardener to maintain the yard, a chef to prepare your meals, and a private jet to whisk you off to exotic locations. And if you were suddenly handed all these things, life would indeed be grand until you got used to them. Unfortunately, after a while, you would become accustomed to the great food and the no-hassle travel, and you'd be hankering for something even better. Problem is, once you are used to life's finest, that hankering can be hard to satisfy. Suppose you go to the best restaurant in town with your wealthy friends. To you, the food is unimaginably good. To your friends, it's just another meal, and yet there's no place better they can eat. I find the same is true in travel. Once you've traveled to many interesting places and seen many interesting things, it becomes harder and harder to find a place to travel to that exceeds your expectations. And I think that's part of happiness is having your expectations exceeded. It's the same is true when you go see a movie. If everyone tells you this movie was fantastic, the best movie I've ever seen, then you go see it with those high expectations, and most of the time it never meets those expectations. Better off setting your bar low and having your expectations exceeded. Article at TechCrunch says, even free can't compete with music piracy. You know, the new Radiohead album they put on their website, radiohead.com, they suggested that you name your own price, anywhere between $0 to whatever. And according to this article in TechCrunch, that over 250,000 users still got the album from peer-to-peer BitTorrent networks. Even though you could go to the Radiohead website and download it for free, 250,000 people still got it from BitTorrent networks. So free is not cheap enough. Well, what is the reason people would use these peer-to-peer BitTorrent networks to get it? One is they already have the software installed, and it's easy for them to just to type in Radiohead and download it. Second thing is the Radiohead site asks you for personal information when you go download their album for free. Yes, they want your name and address and email address and phone number and everything like that. And so I suppose that's why a lot of people don't want to take them up on their free offer. Hillary Clinton in September said that every child born in the United States should get a $5,000 baby bond from the government to help pay for future costs of college or buying a home. I like the idea, too, if they get rid of some other programs and not just add this as another program. So, for example, if you did away with Social Security, for example, for all those children that you're giving $5,000 baby bond to, and it goes into a private account that they can invest in, and they can invest in an all-stock portfolio of globally diversified index funds, U.S. and abroad. And the key to it is, again, get rid of some other program that costs $5,000 per kid. And speaking of politics, one of the podcasts I listen to regularly is Adam Curry. On his show last Wednesday, he had an interview with presidential candidate and 10-term congressman from Texas, Ron Paul. Ron Paul comes from a libertarian background. It seems like libertarians has come up a couple of times on this show when I interviewed Russ Roberts from his Econ Talk podcast. I mentioned to him that a subject that comes up many times on his show is libertarianism and how, you know, we should let the markets be free. Don't let governments regulate things as much. Get the governments out of the mix. And it's interesting how people who are a part of the internet culture, people who have been absorbed in this idea of freedom of information on the internet, that idea apparently is expanding into government. And you can see that a lot of people on the internet are supporting Ron Paul. I wonder if it's a movement or a fad. Let's see if we can tie everything I've said so far on this show together in a song. Blake Morgan covers No Surprises by Radiohead.
A heart that's full up like a landfill, a job that slowly kills you, bruises that won't heal.
Please.
surprises, no alarms and no surprises, please.
Yes. Bring down the government, they don't speak for us. I'll take the quiet life with no alarms and no surprises, please. Microsoft has indicated that next year they may be putting an HD TV tuner in the Xbox game console, along with a much needed larger hard drive, of course. I've often thought that, wow, this Xbox would make a great DVR if it only had a TV tuner in it. And that is what they're considering doing. Fantastic, Microsoft. Now put a web browser in it and we're done, right? We can hook up a wireless keyboard. We can surf the internet and look at YouTube videos on our big screen TV. Article in the New York Sun, Beckham's MLS season stumbles to an end. October 23rd by Paul Gardner. Despite the millions of dollars heaped upon David Beckham by the Galaxy, the English superstar turned out to be a total flop on the field. And it was a rather foolish flop, too, for it was Beckham's own insistence on playing too many games and on playing when he clearly wasn't fit that sabotaged his performance. Now, this is tough for me to say because I'm such a fan of what David Beckham's trying to do. He goes on to say that the awful, unthinkable truth is that the team did better without Beckham. Of the 7 games played by Beckham, 3 of them as a starter, the Galaxy won only one, tying one and losing the other 5. Beckham's contributions shift from feeble to downright embarrassing when one looks at the Galaxy's record over the past month. During that period, the Galaxy, which had been virtually written off as a playoff contender, fought its way back from the abyss with a remarkable 5-game winning streak. 5 games, it needs to be pointed out, in which the injured Beckham did not play. But with the 2 crucial games of the season remaining, Beckham was declared fit. This began to look like the Hollywood script that had been waiting to happen ever since Beckham had arrived in Los Angeles in July. The Golden Boy leading his team to the playoffs and to an impossible victory in the MLS Cup Final. And of course, the LA Galaxy made it to the final game against the Chicago Fire, the winner of which would go to the playoffs. And Gardner writes, but alongside those nice long passes of Beckham's in that game was one disastrous short pass. It came right at the end of the game when Beckham made a hash of a simple 10-yard back pass in midfield. The ball, evidently intended for his teammate Mike Randolph, went instead to, of all people, Blanco, who passed it quickly to Kalen Carr, who moved it in to John Thorrington, who scored. Not to overdramatize, the goal was not fatal, because the Galaxy was doomed to extinction even with the score at 0-0. It needed a win. But the fact that Beckham's final touch of his first season should be a miscue that led to an opponent's goal is suitably symbolic. The first MLS season of the Beckham era has not followed the Hollywood script. Even so, there can be no denying that despite his stumbling contributions on the field, Beckham has had a tremendously positive effect on MLS in general. He's brought an amazing amount of publicity for and interest in both MLS and American soccer in general. And I say, Beckham, we thank you for that, at least. And better luck next season. Got an email from Ken today. Says, hi, Paul, I've been a listener to your show for quite a few months now, and you've convinced me about the follies of stock picking. Recently, I began evaluating my retirement savings plans to try and reduce management fees. My funds were heavy into equities since I'm still in my 30s, but noticed that the management fees in my plans were around the 2% mark. I called the bank my plans are with to move to index funds and chuckled to myself when the person at the bank I was speaking with cautioned me by saying, you know, you'll only make returns equal to that of the market in general. What was going through my mind was what you would think about that comment. Oh, right. Ken continues, ironically, that bank has a really good overview of its various plans on their website, identifying the returns from all their equity plans, and going back over the past 10 years, their index funds nearly always beat their managed plans. When you consider the extra 1.5% that you're paying these so-called experts to manage the plans, there wasn't a single scenario where I was better off than just sticking to an index fund. One comment and question for you. Your show is heavily focused on the U.S. market, but I'm in Canada. and have plans here, which have done very well in recent years, as well as internationally. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on trying to pick funds by global region. Your theme in general seems to be that an individual trying to beat the market is a sucker's game. And on that basis, doesn't it make sense to have all your equity in global funds that spread out your investments over a wide range of countries? Ken. Thanks so much for the email, Ken. Yes, it is, first of all, funny that they say that you're only going to get returns equal to the market. I love Dan Solon's comment, his quote that says, market returns are superior returns. And if you can get the returns of the market, that's just wonderful. And if you can get it with index funds that you don't have to manage over the lifetime that you own them, that's fantastic. As to your question regarding investing globally, absolutely. If you look at some of the example portfolios that are out at IFA.com, you'll see that they recommend something on the order of your equity portion. They recommend something on the order between 20 and 30% in international equities, divided again between developed countries and emerging market countries. And I have heard of people like Merriman on his podcast talk about they recommend 50% in international because international equities represent 50% of the capitalization of the world. One thing that IFA and Mark Hebner would say about that is, well, for a lot of folks, it seems riskier to invest in something you don't follow closely. For example, you turn on the TV or look at the top of the page of the Wall Street Journal, you're going to see the percentage gain in S&P 500, Dow Jones, NASDAQ. Those are all purely U.S. funds. And if your net worth is not somewhat correlated to what they're saying the market is doing, then you're going to be disappointed, aren't you? Well, in my case, I like looking at a portfolio of global investments, and so I don't think I'm going to be disappointed if my holdings may go down even while the U.S. market goes up, but time will tell. Thanks again, Ken, for your question. Good luck, and congratulations that you don't have to pay that extra 1.5% to those so-called experts. Let's play a round of the world's favorite game, Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of investment gurus. I'll spin the wheel and roll the marble, and for the selected guru, give you a little background on their investment philosophy. So here we go! And the winner this time on Random Machine Show 84 is Scott Burns! Scott Burns has covered the changing world of personal finance and investments for nearly 40 years. Today, he ranks as one of the five most widely read personal finance writers in the country, and he writes for the Dallas Morning News. And he is the creator of the Scott Burns Couch Potato Portfolio. In a column that he wrote a couple of years ago, he said, I've advocated index investing and have tracked the Couch Potato Portfolio in this column for more than 30 years. Or was that 13? There are two good reasons for this. First, index investing will do better than about 70% of managed portfolios. Second, index investing is so simple anyone can do it. If you can divide by two on a calculator, you can be a couch potato manager. But a nagging question remains. Could we increase the return or reduce the risk by adding more funds? Okay, so you see that the couch potato portfolio, the way he had created that was 50% in the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index and 50% in the Vanguard Inflation Protected Securities. Well, he added a second portfolio then called the Margarita portfolio, and it's three funds. The two I mentioned plus the Vanguard Total International Stock Index. Then he added another fund and called it his Four Square portfolio, equal amounts of four funds, added the American Century International Bond Fund. He said that returns us to the basic 50-50 equities or fixed income mix, but it commits half of our money to international investments, half to domestic. Then he added another fund and called it the Five-Fold portfolio, equal amounts of five funds, and in there he added the Vanguard REIT index fund. And then finally, In his Six Ways from Sunday portfolio, it's equal amounts of six funds, he adds the Vanguard Energy Fund. Now, the Vanguard Energy Fund is a managed fund with a very low expense ratio, he writes. Unfortunately, it was recently closed to new investors. An alternative is its exchange-traded fund, the Vanguard Vipers Energy. He says, while no market scholar will argue that energy stocks are a separate asset class, I offer this rationale. Energy is the ultimate currency and the ultimate commodity. Whether we are talking about grain, chicken, beef, iron, copper, or gold, every commodity in our daily lives is directly affected by the cost and availability of energy. The best way for most people to invest in energy is through the stocks of major energy companies. Well, in just a few minutes, I'm going to look at the performance of the Scott Burns Six Ways from Sunday portfolio, and I'll talk a little bit more about the composition of his Six Ways from Sunday portfolio. But congratulations, Scott Burns, you're the guru on Mad Money Machine Show 84. Well, like I mentioned, I have done an examination of Scott Burns' portfolio. And at the website, I'll have a link to it in the show notes, and you can look at it on the website, an article called Lazy Portfolio Risk Analysis. And with that tool that I mentioned a few shows back, the SMF Excel plugin, the Stock Market Functions Excel plugin, I was able to actually pull historical prices for all of the funds in these lazy portfolios and then calculate their return over the time and the risk. So let me talk a little bit about that. First of all, the return. What am I talking about here? I'm talking about the annualized return of the portfolio, and I chose a starting time of the beginning of the millennium, or rather, the 1st of January 2000, which some people say is not the beginning of the millennium. But anyway, the beginning of the 2000s. From the beginning of the 2000s until the beginning of October this month, I've calculated the annualized return of several of these lazy portfolios. And then I also calculated the risk. Now, what do we mean by risk? In this case, I took from the historical Yahoo Finance website, I pulled the monthly prices for each one of the funds. And what we compute there is we simply go into Excel and we say compute the standard deviation of the monthly gain or loss from the previous month. Right, so if it goes up 1% from the previous month, it may go down 1% the next month and up 2% the next month. Well, we calculate then of all those monthly changes the standard deviation and multiply that by the square root of 12. And I don't even know why that formula works like that, other than the fact that 12 is the number of months in a year. And standard deviation has something to do with the square root calculation and all that. But let's leave that aside for the moment. That's the way we calculate annualized risk of these portfolios. How far can we expect this thing to swing up and down while we own it? And so out at the website, the winning portfolio by return was the Scott Burns Six Ways from Sunday portfolio in its equity portion only. All right, so if I pull out his bond component and just use the equity component, it was the winner, up almost 16% annualized over that period. And then I sorted them by risk, and the lowest risk one was the coffee house portfolio, Bill Schulte's, but it also had a fairly low annualized return of 9%. So how do you make sense of all this together? Well, you plot the return and the risk on a chart, a scatter plot more specifically. And if you scroll down and look at that chart, you'll see the left-hand side is the returns that the portfolio got over those, almost 8 years. And across the bottom then is the amount of risk. Where do you want to be on this chart? You want to be top and left. You want to have as little risk and as much return as you can. Unfortunately, that's not the way the world appears to work. The way the world appears to work is that as you go out to the right, as you go up, you tend to go out to the right. As you increase your returns that you're striving for, you're also taking on more risk. Or said another way, if you take on more risk, you can expect a higher returns. And you can almost draw a line from lower left up to upper right, and these portfolios then track along that line. And that line is called the efficient frontier. And I use that line in the icon for my show. It's a curved line in my case, but here you could draw a straight line. The Scott Burns portfolios would appear to be above the line where most of the other portfolios are. And I think this is a case of data mining because Scott Burns has chosen a particular sector in energy, and he is very heavily weighted in not only energy, but also in REITs. And both of those have done fantastically well over that particular period. If you go much farther back in time, though, those sectors had not done as well, and the Scott Burns portfolio wouldn't be up as high as it is over a much longer time period. What is amazing to me, absolutely amazing, is of all of these portfolios that I've studied, the index folio portfolios, 190, are the best ones that are out there. You can see that they are higher for the amount of risk that you're taking. They returned the highest amount of return. Everything else falls below the slope of where the index folio portfolios lie in this graph. Now, if you continue going down on that web page, you will see something new from IFA. And let's call that this week's tool in the crib. This is the risk-reward optimization chart. And if you click on that chart in my web posting, it will take you out to the spot at ifa.com. And in fact, you can click on the enlarge button once you get out there, bottom left of the chart, and it will fill your entire browser window now with this flash chart showing where funds and index folios and individual stocks from the Dow Jones lie on this risk and return scatter plot. And it's fascinating to look at the fact that even Microsoft, with the fantastic returns it has had for 20 years, still falls below the efficient frontier line. It's all about the risk. It's all about the relationship of risk to returns. But look at this chart. Berkshire Hathaway has about the same risk return as the emerging markets funds. Home Depot had a greater return for that period, but it still falls under the efficient frontier line. But look at all the other Dow Jones 30 stocks. They fall way under the efficient frontier line. In fact, some of them don't even meet the return of Index Folio 100 at much higher risk, though. The best way to squeeze out all the return you can get from the amount of risk that you're taking is to invest in an enormously diversified portfolio of stocks, and that would be in a portfolio of index funds. That's our tool in the crib for this time, the IFA Risk Reward Optimization Graph. And like all the other tools I've given you so far, except for one, this one's free. I want to thank you so much for listening. I crave your feedback. So if you've got anything to say about the show whatsoever, email me, feedback@madmanmachine.com, or call the voicemail line, 206-734-4763. That's 20 MP3 for iPod. Or just visit madmanmachine.com and make a comment in the show notes of this or any show. I'll get it. Thank you so much. This is Paul Douglas Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes something to be enthusiastic about to make a Mad Money machine. I'll see you next week. In the meantime, visit our sponsor at ifa.com, matching people with portfolios. Take their risk capacity survey. Some music on this show provided by music.podshow.com.